Okay. So I'm going to, since this is our last session, I'm going to pop ahead a little bit. That's, like I said, we'll have some time for questions at the end, so if I end up as I hop and skip forward, skipping something you really want to talk about, just ask and we'll cover it. So after there's this cycle of the seven seals being broken on the scroll, and then when the seventh seal is broken, that starts another cycle of seven trumpets being blown. This is one of the things that's true of all of St. John's writings. It's true of St. John's Gospel. It's true of 1 John. It's true of the Apocalypse. It probably would be true of 2 and 3 John if they were more than a paragraph long, but it's hard to structure something that's that short. But they're structured in this sort of cyclical pattern, where there's a series of cycles. So for example, St. John's Gospel is structured around three cycles of the Jewish feasts. There's three Passovers, three Pentecosts, three as you move through. 1 John is set up in much the same way. There are themes introduced at the beginning, and then they're sort of returned to and developed sort of cyclically. And the same is true here in the Apocalypse, where you have these cycles beginning and ending. And the trumpets are judgments and are very much, again, there's hail mixed with fire. There are things that refer us back to the plagues upon Egypt and have that same significance. And so I'm going to move ahead a little bit and pick up in chapter 12, verse 1, where the narrative shifts. We've been going through these judgment cycles, and now we're going to get sort of a symbolic story. So in chapter 12, verse 1, St. John says that he sees a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on its head 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. So there's a whole bunch of stuff there. This is where it starts getting weird, right? One of the big debates about this passage by interpreters is whether the woman is the Theotokos or whether the woman is Israel. And the answer to that question is yes. Right? that
standard seminary procedure.
Yeah. So we don't have to choose one, right? Because the purpose of God's calling of Israel, the purpose of having this people in the world, right? We sometimes miss the transition that happens in Genesis at the beginning of chapter 12 of Genesis. Genesis 11 is the story of the Tower of Babel, and then it goes right into Abraham. Right? So in Genesis 11, God has just taken all the people of the earth and scattered them into 70 nations. There's a table of nations there that lists all of them. There are 70 nations that make up the world. He's scattered them all. He's disinherited them. Right? They're gone. He comes to Abraham then immediately afterwards in the text of Genesis to make a new one. Right? To make a new one. To make a nation for himself. Right? That doesn't already exist. God doesn't pick one of the 70 and say, I pick this one, I love this one best, this one's my elect nation, the rest of them can go. All of them are disinherited, and he creates a new one. This, by the way, is the meaning of God's name in the Old Testament. Yahweh comes from the verb hawa in Hebrew. It's what's called the hifil. Hebrew is confusing, but it's what's called a hifil. A hifil is a type of verb that is causative, right? So in Exodus, when God says his name to Abraham, he says his name is Ahia, I am, right? But the name as it's remembered is Yahweh, right, which is in the hifil, which means he who causes things to be. And he expands on this title several times, particularly when addressing Israel, that God is the one who calls things into being that were not before. And this has obvious relevance to Genesis 1, right, where God speaks and things come into existence, but it also has to do with the nation of Israel that he creates from nothing. Right? But his purpose in creating this nation is to undo three things that happened in Genesis 1 through 11. Genesis 1, Adam disobeys in the garden and human beings become mortal. Death, that's problem one. Right after that, we have the story of Cain and Abel. Cain murders his brother. Right? Even though Adam and Eve had become mortal, they weren't the first people to die. Abel was the first person to die. Because Cain murders him. Right? He's the one who actively brings death into the world. So when you read commentary from the Second Temple Jewish period, Cain is the one who's considered the first sinner, not Adam. Because they view Adam as having been innocent and confused and mistaken and then repentant. Whereas Cain sins deliberately and unrepentantly. This is why, for example, in 1 John, it talks about Cain when he's talking about sin. He goes back to Cain, not to Adam. And so you have Cain, and then the genealogy of Cain, it just gets worse and worse. Right? We just read this a couple of weeks ago at Pre-Sanctified Liturgy. Right? That genealogy that culminates with Lamech singing his song to his two wives, because he's the first polygamist in the Bible. Right, about how great he is and how he's taken such horrible vengeance on everyone who's wronged him by murdering them. Right, and if Cain was avenged sevenfold, I'm avenged 70 times sevenfold. Right, so it just gets worse. So the first problem is death. The second problem is sin and wickedness and corruption that corrupts the earth, as we were saying before with the biological view of sin. Corrupts the whole earth, and that's why God has to send the flood. To purify the whole thing. And then the third problem is the nations being scattered and disinherited. And we're going to see in the New Testament, part of what St. Paul sees as happening is that these problems are resolved in the reverse order. After Pentecost, the nations are called back to God through faith in Jesus Christ. Through repentance, in the church, we're cleansed and purified from sin. And then death, which he describes as the last enemy, is finally destroyed when Christ returns. So we have these three problems at the beginning, resolved in reverse order. Abraham is called to begin the process of reversing those things. So the whole purpose of Israel's existence is to bring forth the Messiah. The whole purpose of Israel's existence is to bring forth Christ. Right? So is the woman here who gives birth to Christ Israel or the Theotokos? The answer is yes. Right? Because she stands at this culmination point, right, of Israel's history and brings them forth. And you notice that he is caught up to the throne of God. That's referring to Christ's ascension. And then she has to flee to the wilderness, right? Because Israel didn't cease to exist. Right? Israel continues to exist in purified and renewed form in the church. So what this is describing is exactly what Christ told his disciples in St. John's Gospel. He told them very clearly, when I am gone, right? If they hated me, they will hate you. When they persecute you, know that they persecuted me first, right? And so when he ascends into heaven, the devil, the dragon, can't come after Christ directly anymore, because he's ascended to his throne. So who does he come after? He comes after his church, right? Comes after his church. A couple more points about the devil here. The word dragon is the word that's used, drakon, in Greek in Genesis 2 and 3, that we translate as serpent. But in Greek, it's nakash. In Hebrew, it's drakon in Greek. So he's setting us up with who this person is, right? It's not ambiguous. He's got seven heads, and he's got 10 horns and seven on each head, and 7 crowns. If you do the math on that, if he's got 7 heads and there's 10 horns on each, that's 70 horns. That's how many nations there are in the world. So that's this, the devil being the prince of this world idea, right? That he's come into control of the world. Now, I'm going to tell you something that may be shocking, because many of you have probably heard this interpreted, that when the dragon falls to earth and he sweeps a third of the stars out of heaven, that that's Satan falling with a third of the angels. Nobody thought that until John Milton in the 16th century wrote Paradise Lost. So this is not what St. Andrew of Caesarea says. This is not what any of the fathers say. The idea that before the world was created, Satan and a group of angels fell, right, is from Milton. I know you've heard it your whole life. Right? And this is the only verse in the Bible that you could even point to. But what St. Andrew of Caesarea gets to this verse and considers it a problem. Right? He says, well, there's a problem here. Because, number one, this happens after Christ is born. Right? Here in the book of Revelation. And he says, and this is a quote from St. Andrew, he says, all the fathers say that after the creation of the world, the devil fell out of envy. So he says, all the fathers say. This was the view not only in all of the Second Temple Jewish literature, right, but in all of the early Christian literature, up to the time of St. Andrew and beyond, was that what we read about the serpent being cursed in Genesis 3, that's when the devil fell. That's the devil's fall. Right there. So the story of the serpent being cursed to crawl on his belly on the ground is not how snakes lost their legs, right? Like Rudyard Kipling wrote it. Or how they lost the ability to talk. This is the curse of Satan. Right? And an especially important element of that is when it says you will eat the dust of the earth. Right? Ancient people knew snakes did not eat dust and dirt. They knew they ate other animals. That's not what it's talking about. Because the curse on Adam, remember, was dust you are, to dust you will return. Right? So this is where the dragon, the serpent, is given the power of death. That's the only power he has left to him as he's thrown out of heaven, is death. And this is what St. Paul's getting at in his discussion of death as the last enemy. When he says, death, where is thy sting? Death, where is thy victory? Right? That Christ is now disarmed and taken that even away from him through the resurrection. Right? So now Satan doesn't even have that. Okay. So this is not describing that. What is this describing? Well, St. Andrew connects this, which takes place after the birth of Christ, to what Christ says to the 70 when they return from their mission of healing. He says, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Right? He says, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. He says, St. Andrew says, this is the same event. And this is appealing to a different set of traditions about Satan that we see, for example, in the book of Job. In the book of Job, we see all of God's angels come into his council chamber to present themselves to him, and also the Satan, right, according to Job, comes. And he starts to make those accusations, right, against Job. And this is a trope that you find all through Jewish literature through this period. And they associate it especially with St. Michael. St. Michael, according to Daniel, is Israel's angel. Right? He is the angel, sort of the guardian angel or the patron of the nation of Israel. Right? And so this depiction of, you on one side you have Satan making accusations, and on the other side you have St. Michael defending. Right, and it's back and forth. This is where what St. Jude refers to in the Epistle of Jude, when he talks about St. Michael and Satan contesting over the body of Moses. Right? This is what was believed to happen when someone died. When someone died, a righteous person died, Satan would come to make accusations. Right, and then St. Michael was sent to collect Moses and defend against those accusations. This is where our understanding in the church of it being St. Michael who casts Satan out of heaven comes from. Right? And so what this is saying is, now that Christ has been born, now that Christ is incarnate, right, Satan has no more place to make accusations. That's why he's cast out of heaven at that point. That's why St. Michael finally tosses him out, right? Because forgiveness of sins comes through Christ, which means he can no longer accuse. It's what St. Paul is referring to when he says there's now no condemnation in Christ Jesus. He says, who is there to make an accusation against God's elect? Because Satan has lost that role. So that's the fall that's being referred to here, right? That through Christ's ministry, Satan, who was, right, remember the 70 nations, who was the prince of this world, now is cast down and stripped of that power. Because, as St. John says here, the male child who is born is one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. All the nations with a rod of iron. So, in verse 7, it describes Michael and his angels throwing the dragon down to earth. There's no longer any place for him in heaven. He no longer has this role as an accuser. And so there's sort of a victory celebration in heaven and sort of some lamentation and mourning on earth because now he's here. Right? And this is where St. John's idea of why the devil now is so ravenous, right? He knows he's licked, right? He has no power left to him except to try to drag people down with him. When we get to the end, we're going to see that there's this lake of fire prepared for the devil and his angels, not prepared for people, right? Prepared for the devil and his angels. And what he's trying, all he's got left to himself is to try to drag as many people there with him as he can on his way. Okay. And so how does he do this? Well, in chapter 13, verse 1, we get our first beast. Right? There are going to be a couple of beasts. This one is the famous one. I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. Okay. So again, we've got this 70 nations imagery. Right? But notice this isn't the dragon. Right? This is a beast that comes forth out of the sea. The reason he comes out of the sea is that the sea is a symbol going all the way back into the Old Testament. The Hebrew word for sea is Yam, and Yam was actually a god in Canaanite mythology, the sea, that represents just sort of chaos. Right? We might like the ocean, going out on a boat, going fishing, right? Or might not. But at that time, you know, maritime science was not what it is now. Right? They didn't have scuba gear and snorkels. Right? The sea was dangerous. Storms came in off the sea. People went off to sea and never came back. Right? It was just this side of chaos and destruction. Right? So the fact that he comes up out of the sea indicates where his allegiances are, right? And part of what he represents. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth, and to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. What St. John has done here in this vision is put together pieces of four beasts that Daniel saw. Daniel saw four, had this vision of four beasts that were four empires that were coming, that represented the Babylonians, the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks, and then the Romans. Right? This one is made up of bits and pieces of all of them put together. Right? Not because there's going to be some future conglomeration of Medes, Persians, Greeks, right? We're going to take over the world. But because this beast represents all of these human governments that receive their authority from the dragon. Right? So this is that parallel again. We've got the dragon who, through the power of sin, is exercising dominion over the world. These are now, the beast now represents the agents, the empires, the human governments, right, who are doing his bidding in the world. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" Now there's going to be more evidence for this coming up, but I'll telegraph it a little. This thing that the beast had one head that seemed to be mortally wounded, but had survived. This is talking about a particular tradition, and we'll get into a little more detail about it later, that was going around in Rome about the Emperor Nero. Notice it's one of the heads. It's not the whole beast. It's one head. Rome is just one head. And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opens its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. So we have to remember at this time in history, there's no separation of church and state or temple and state. These were not separate things. All right? So to refuse to worship the emperor was treason against the Roman Empire. There was actually a goddess, Roma Patria, the Rome, the fatherland, where they worshipped Rome itself, right, and offered incense. So this is the connection St. John is making, is that yes, by worshiping it, they're worshiping the dragon. Ultimately, they're worshiping the devil. But that his human authorities themselves become the objects of worship and reverence for people, for all those who aren't followers of Christ. They end up worshiping this world and its systems of power and authority. He says, "Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon." Well, that should tip you off, right? Remember, Christ is portrayed as the lamb who was slain. So this looks like a lamb. It looks like Christ, right? But when it talks, it's coming straight from the devil. It's coming from the dragon. "It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and most of your translations will have, and his number is 666. Some of the earliest copies of the book of Revelation that we have actually have 616 as the number. But I'll get to that in a second. So we have this false Messiah, right? This Antichrist figure show up, who is involved in creating this religious system to worship the beast. So we have sort of the political system and the religious system, and they're working in tandem. Right? And this imagery, again, we're going back to Daniel. Remember what happens to the three youths in the book of Daniel? Nebuchadnezzar makes this image of himself, commands everyone to worship it. If you don't worship it, you'll be killed. Right? So this is a similar thing. This is a pattern. This isn't just a one-time event, right? That there are forces operating to try and get some of the people who were called out in the cover letters, right? Who are inside the Christian communities, trying to get them to participate in the worship of the world, in sexual immorality and these other sinful things. Right? They're these false teachers, and they're cooperating with the devil's political, what we would call political power, power over the world. So the reference to being unable to buy and sell and trade is likely connected to the practice in the Roman Empire during many of the persecutions, where you had to go and offer incense to the genius of the emperor. Genius here is more like genie and less like the way we think of genius, although it's related. What we think of as demonic possession, right, what we see in the Bible as demonic possession and see as a bad thing, the ancient Greeks and Romans thought was a good thing. In several of his dialogues, Socrates talks about the demon that indwells him and whispers wisdom to his soul. In defending himself, he says this, right, to people. They believed that people who were what we would call geniuses, people who were gifted, who were talented, this was because some spirit, some divine spirit, had come to dwell within them and lead them to these things. And so they believed this was true about the emperor as well, that the emperor had this divine spirit dwelling within him, which in Latin they called a genius. And that's ultimately where our word genius is derived from. But so you had to go and sacrifice to the genius of the emperor. Right, and if you did not go and if you offered the sacrifice, they gave you a small clay token, this little clay chip, right, to prove you had done it. Well, Christians, of course, refused to do this. Right, so at any time when you were trying to conduct commerce, at any time when you were in the public square, the Roman soldiery could come and ask to see, you know, the proof that you had gone and done this, and if you didn't have it, you could be executed, you could be thrown in prison, depending on who you were, whether you were a Roman citizen or not. If you weren't, you'd be summarily executed. If you were, you had some more rights and you'd just end up in prison for the rest of your life, probably, awaiting a trial that would never come. So that's most likely what this is referring to. But it's also emblematic of this whole dilemma we talked about earlier that Christians face, of having to sort of completely retract from civic life, not being able to participate in it, not being able to go and buy meat from the meat market. This is why St. Paul says some people will eat only vegetables. They won't touch any meat at all because it's all been used for this. And so we get this number. There are two very good candidates for what this number is. The first one is the Emperor Nero again. There's this mention of this this wound that was healed. There was a belief after Nero died that he hadn't actually died. Right? That he had been seriously wounded, he'd snuck off somewhere, and they differed as to where he had snuck off to, and had healed up, and he was going to return to save the Roman Empire and bring it back to glory. It's a persistent belief. We have it in, it's referenced by Dio Chrysostom, who's not St. John Chrysostom, he was a pagan, but Dio Chrysostom, who lived in the 90s, right around the time that St. John had his vision. It existed then. It continued in the Roman Empire for centuries. St. Augustine refers to it in the City of God. He talks about how when the city of Rome was falling in the 5th century, a bunch of the pagans came out of the woodwork saying Nero was going to return from the dead and save the Roman Empire from collapsing if they turned back to paganism. So this hung on for a long, long time. And if you add up we have to remember, these are Arabic numerals that we use, right? They're referred to as Arabic numerals. That's because they come from the Arabic language. Before that, there weren't numerals. Hebrew, Greek, there are no numbers the way we think of them. They used letters to give numbers. That's why sometimes when you get different Bible translations, or if you compare something translated from the Greek of the Old Testament to something translated from the Hebrew of the Old Testament, you'll see the numbers are different. Right? That's because there's some confusion sometimes because they're using letters for numbers. So if you do the letters to numbers transfer here, the title Nero Caesar in Greek adds up to 666. Interestingly, in Aramaic, it adds up to 616. So it covers both both versions. So that may be a source of the two different numbers in the different copies. But it's not just pointing to him as an individual, because the other really good candidate for the meaning of 666 comes from what's called a magic square, which is something that was used in pagan worship at this time. Anybody here do Sudoku puzzles? These are like the original Sudoku puzzles. A magic square. And one of them in particular was a 3x3 square. You'd write the numbers 1 through 9 in it, patterned in such a way that it added up the same way in all directions, and gave you the number 666, and this was a symbol of Zeus. Okay. So is it Zeus or is it Nero? Can anybody predict what my answer is going to be?
Yes.
Yes. Because remember, as we said earlier, the ancients didn't distinguish between the human agent and the spiritual power that was standing behind that human agent. Right? So, yes, Zeus, who we've already seen referred to as Satan several times, right? Remember the throne of Satan, is there standing behind Caesar. Right? And Nero, who killed Saints Peter and Paul, sort of emblematic of the worst kind of Caesar, right? Of the most hostile to the church. So that's who it's referring to. But so, because it's not just Nero as an individual, right? We see again that this is a pattern. This is a pattern. This is true of the world, not just at the time St. John wrote it, not just when we get near the end of it, but all the way through. Right? All the way through. That between the time of Christ's ascension into heaven and the time of his return, the devil is here on earth, right? Just trying to destroy. And he's using human agents in positions of power and authority on this earth, and he's using false religious systems to do it. Right? He's the one acting through these things. Right? And so, reiterating what we saw in the cover letters, right? We as Christians need to separate ourselves from these systems, not fall into worshiping them. Right? Not falling into devoting ourselves to them, following them, pursuing them, right? Making them our highest value rather than Christ. Okay, so we're going to skip forward a little bit again. There's another cycle of plagues that come from angels who pour out seven bowls of God's wrath upon the earth. It's important when we talk about God's wrath, right? Because of some of our kind of cockeyed Western views of God sometimes, God's wrath is not him getting angry. Okay, it's not him going, right? Okay. We're very small, right? Nothing we do could actually act upon God to make him angry. Okay, that's not how this works. We talked before a little bit when I was talking about St. John's use of the blood of Christ forgiving us of sins, and talking about the world being under the power of the devil, about the Day of Atonement, the Day of Atonement ritual, and how it was there to purify this space so that God could continue to dwell among his people, right? Part of that is that the Day of Atonement ritual is given as a response to an event that happened. I mentioned that when Moses took the elders of Israel partway up Mount Sinai, Aaron and his two sons came with them. Aaron's two sons didn't do so well later in life. Right after God's presence came to fill the tabernacle, Aaron's two sons, Nadab and Abihu, who the text kind of implies were drunk at the time, went in at the wrong time and in the wrong way to offer incense while inebriated. And the fire of God came out and consumed them. The Day of Atonement ritual is instituted in response to that happening. And part of it that isn't focused on, everybody focuses on the two goats, right? The one goat's blood gets used, the other goat gets sent out into the wilderness. But another part of it is the offering of incense in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And the reason incense has to be offered is that during the Day of Atonement ritual, God himself appears on his throne above the Ark of the Covenant. And if the high priest back there sees him, he will die. So he has to offer a great cloud of incense so that he won't, right? There's this covering between him and between him and God. God coming to dwell in the midst of his people is dangerous for his people if they're going to sin. If they're going to continue to live in sin and iniquity, one of two things is going to happen. Either God's going to have to leave, right? Or they're going to be consumed by the fire of his holiness. And so the Day of Atonement ritual is a way to deal with that. By the one goat receiving the sins of the people and taking them out of the camp, and by the blood of the other goat being used to cleanse the sanctuary and the camp from sort of the taint and residue of sin. So when we talk about God's wrath, what we mean is that fire of his holiness. And in the prayers after communion, right, we say that God is a fire consuming the unworthy. Right? And we say, consume me not, O my Creator. Right? The prayer of Manasseh that we do in Great Compline. We say, do not destroy me with my sins. I would very much like God to destroy my sins, but not me with them. Right? And so this is what we're talking about when we're talking about God's wrath. What God's wrath and these plagues are doing when these bowls are poured out is not destroying the world, not condemning the world, not expressing that he's angry at the world, because we've already been told he loves the world, right? But they're purging and purifying the world from the wickedness and the sin that's upon it, right? And that purging, that purifying isn't pleasant, really, for the world as it undergoes it. But it's a necessary thing. So chapter 17, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Okay. So here's another related vision. This beast sounds a lot like the other beasts, right? We've got the 7 heads and the 10 horns, but now there's this woman riding on it who is referred to as Babylon. Now remember, we had another woman at the beginning of chapter 12 who was the Theotokos in Israel, right? And so we have this polarity of these two women. The other woman is Babylon. Babylon, we may immediately go to Israel going into exile in Babylon. But Babylon shows up a lot earlier than that in the Bible. Because remember, it's the Tower of Babel. Right? What's being constructed there is the ziggurat, is the temple in the city of Babylon. So it is emblematic of sort of human civilization as it is opposed to God. It's the culmination of that line starting with Cain. Remember, the first thing Cain does is go and build a city. Right? So it's this culmination of this line of Cain, of human civilization as it is hostile to God. Right? And you notice she's drunk. This is conjuring up the imagery of from Proverbs, Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly, right, that we see referred to over and over and over again. Right? Someone is going to belong to one of these two women. Someone is going to be a child of one of these two women. Either the Theotokos and God's people, or of Babylon. So it talks about her sitting on 7 hills and sitting across rivers, and those are pretty clear references to the city of Rome. But that's not because he's just talking about Rome in the first century. But in the first century AD, Rome was how she manifested herself. Just as it was Babylon 6 centuries earlier. Right? And someone else before that. Right? And someone else today. And someone else in every era along where this has manifested itself. This sort of folly and this woman who claims ownership of people as her children, who is opposed to God and who leads them to destruction. Right? To destruction. And so it's not coincidental that we also have this polarity between a virgin and a prostitute. Right? As opposites. And so when St. John sees her, he marvels, and then in chapter 18, Babylon falls. And the whole world goes into mourning over the greatness of the city that has fallen. This is referring to the fall of Rome. It's also referring to the fall of all those other cities. Right? Babylon was destroyed. In their turn, all of these cities rise up and they're destroyed, and everyone thinks it's the end of the world. That's why St. Augustine wrote The City of God. Right? It's because even the Christians at that time thought that the fall of Rome was the end of the world. And he had to tell them, no, there's a city of man, and this is one of them. They all fall. And there's a city of God that is eternal. We'll see more of the city of God as we go forward. So that lamenting on the earth as everyone cries and mourns that Babylon has fallen, there's then rejoicing in heaven that Babylon has fallen. Right? And we see this shift in perspective. Right, this is part of the point that St. John's making with the whole vision. Right, that we need to shift our perspective from an earthly material perspective to take in the spiritual reality and to see our physical reality, our day-to-day life, through the lens of this overarching spiritual reality so that we understand what it means. And after that rejoicing, we see St. John's depiction of Christ's return. This is described with two images. First, it's described as a marriage supper, the marriage supper of the Lamb. This goes back to imagery that's in St. John's Gospel also. It's St. John who tells us about how when Christ hung on the cross after his death, when they came and they broke the legs of the other crucified victims, they came to Jesus, they didn't break his legs. Remember, they took the spear, they opened up his side, and blood and water flowed out. Right? And St. John, all throughout the crucifixion of Christ, I won't digress too much on it, but all throughout the crucifixion of Christ is referring us back to Genesis 2. But especially here, because of course, Adam gets put into a trance, I think the Orthodox Study Bible has, but gets put into a deep sleep is what the King James Version has. It's like he's dead. And what does it say? God takes his side and makes for him a wife, right? Makes for him a bride. I'll digress a little here, because the fact that the King James Version translated that as rib has haunted us all for four centuries. The word there isn't rib. It's side, like dorsal and ventral. So what the Hebrew text is literally saying there is that God took Adam and pulled him in half. And he took the one half and made it into a woman. And then built out the rest of Adam. Right? And that's why when Adam wakes up, he says, "This is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." And this is why a man shall leave his father's house and cleave to his wife. Because when the two come together in marriage, the two become one again. Right? And that's why Christ says, "What God has joined together, let no man pull back asunder." That's the imagery there. Well, St. John appeals to this imagery as Christ hangs on the cross, that his side is open up and blood and water flow out. If you go to 1 John, he says that Christ came not only by water, but by water and blood. He attaches this to baptism and to the Eucharist. Because baptism and the Eucharist are the two things that constitute the church, Christ's people, Christ's bride. Right? They make a bride for him. And so the ultimate fulfillment here as Christ returns is this marriage supper, this celebration of this marriage that has taken place. And in a few weeks here, you'll hear in the hymns of Pascha about Christ emerging from the tomb as from a bridal chamber. Right? As he consummates this union with us. Right, in the church. And so St. John speaks of that, and then he speaks about Christ riding in victoriously on a white horse in his return as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. There's then another supper. I'll read it. He says, "Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and with a loud voice he called to all the birds that fly directly overhead, 'Come gather for the great supper of God, to eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and their riders, and the flesh of all men, both free and slave, both small and great.'" And so all of the wicked who have perished opposing Christ become this feast for all the animals, right, in the world. So the point of that, even though it's kind of gory and gruesome, is that God includes his whole creation in this great feast. Right? They're not, you know, the birds and dogs and cats are not part of the marriage, right, with Christ. But they are invited to celebrate, right, in their own way. So what Christ does in his return embraces the whole creation. Right? Not just human beings, but the whole creation now is rejoicing because of what's happening. Okay, so now in chapter 20, this is the passage that the Kiliasts lit upon, that many of a premillennial bent in our own day light upon, that talks about the 1,000 years. It says, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who was the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the pit and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while. Okay, so we have this image of the devil being bound, right, in chains and imprisoned under the earth for this period of time, after which he is let out. What does this binding refer to? Well, you'll see a big spoiler if you look at an icon of the resurrection, which is technically the icon of the harrowing of hell. Because you'll see a figure at the bottom of that icon, right there. I've got a mobile mic, I can walk over here. You'll see a figure here under the gates of hell that have been kicked down in the form of a cross, who is bound in chains, right? That's the devil. Why is he bound? Well, he's bound because he's had, as we've talked about already, he's had all of his authority, all of his power, right? The few things he had left to him, like the power of death, have all been stripped away from him now by Christ. Right? So he's under these restrictions, right? Then I saw thrones, and seated on them were those to whom the authority to judge was committed. Also I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and for the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or its image, and had not received its mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him for 1,000 years. So he talks about the first resurrection, right? And then talks about that there will be a second resurrection. And the first resurrection here is of martyrs, saints, those who have kept themselves pure from the world. And then there's the rest, right? That's all the other people. Because remember, the resurrection is everybody. Right? The resurrection is everyone. So it includes the righteous and the unrighteous. Christ says in St. John's Gospel, the time is coming and now is when all those who lay in the tombs will hear the voice of the Son of God. Those who hear will live. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation, right? But everyone is raised from the dead. This is important to remember because there are passages in the New Testament that talk about everyone being saved, right? And there are passages in the New Testament that make it pretty clear that maybe there are some people who fall under condemnation, right? And this is key to understanding that. The resurrection, the defeat of death by Christ, affects everyone. That's why at Pascha we say all these things, like not a single one remains in the graves, right? That this is universal. This affects everyone. Everyone who, because of Adam, became subject to death, now because of Christ, as St. Paul says in Romans 5, right, will live, will rise from the dead, right? But St. John here has separated this into two events. And there's actually precedent for this if we read St. John's Gospel. When Christ comes to Lazarus' tomb and Martha comes out to meet him, right, he says to her, "Do you believe in the resurrection of the dead?" She says, "Yes, I believe the righteous will be raised up on the last day." Right? That's her understanding. Yes, someday when the Lord visits his people, everyone will be raised from the dead. Christ says, "I am the resurrection and the life," meaning the resurrection has already come. And when the Sadducees come to Jesus, because the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection of the dead, and they come to him to test him, and they say, "Well, okay, so there was a woman who was married to this guy, and he died, and they didn't have any kids, so they followed the law and the Torah, and she married his brother, and they didn't have any kids, and she married his other brother, and his other brother," right? And you have one bride for seven brothers at the end of it. Right, they say, "Okay, Jesus, whose wife is she?" Right, in the resurrection. Right, and Jesus says, "You don't get it." right? That's not how the resurrection works. But then he says to them, concerning the resurrection of the dead, is it not written, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Which means not only are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob still living in some sense, he says concerning the resurrection. They're already resurrected in some sense. Right? And so this is what St. John is talking about. Right? This is what St. John is talking about. That the righteous, the saints, right, are already resurrected, are already reigning with Christ in the heavenly places. Before that day comes when everyone is raised from the dead. So he said, blessed are those who participate in the first resurrection. Right? So this thousand-year period, this long period of time where Satan is bound and where they're reigning, is a period we're in right now. It's describing that period of time between Christ's ascension and his return. Now, what are the saints who have already been resurrected? Right? We've already been told that they're ruling and reigning with Christ. Right? As he said to his apostles, you'll sit on 12 thrones and judge the 12 tribes of Israel, right? Meaning rule over them. So they're already doing that. He also says they will be priests of God and of Christ. Okay? So they're ruling with him and they're priests. And again, this is hierius. This isn't they'll be elders. This isn't they'll be presbyters. This is hierius. They'll be temple priests. What did priests do? They had two functions. 1 John 2, 1 and 2 describe these two functions. The second function in 1 John 2, verse 2 is they offer sacrifices. Okay? Well, they're not going to be, the saints in glory aren't offering animal sacrifices, right? to Christ. But in 1 John 2, verse 1, they served as intercessors. They offered prayers and supplications for the sins and the ignorances of the people. They interceded for the people before God. So what are the saints in glory doing according to Revelation chapter 20? They're ruling and reigning with Christ in the same way that we talked about the angels doing it. Christ administers his rule over creation through his holy ones, his angels and these resurrected saints, which is why we have patron saints of places and people and churches, and they're interceding. They're interceding for Christ's people. They're praying for us. Right? And so this idea in the Orthodox Church of the Saints' intercessions goes back all the way. It's here in the scriptures. It actually goes back into the Old Testament. There are references even in Job to people seeking the intercessions of angels. Right? But now that also includes the departed saints. So then, when the thousand years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out. This is all shifted to future tense. Right? The previous was present tense, which St. John uses what's called the historical present. Right? He narrates everything in the present tense, but he shifts to future here. So that's all something that's already happening. This now, he goes to the future. When the thousand years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea, and they marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them, and the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Okay? So he gets loose right at the end, right, to work some evil, and then he is defeated. Gog and Magog, If you read the Old Testament closely, are not nations. Magog isn't Russia, right? Gog isn't China. I know people, again, pin the tail on the Antichrist, want to identify them with somebody. But if you read Amos in the Greek translation, the Greek Old Testament, it identifies Gog as the king of the locusts. Right? These are basically demonic figures. So they're to represent, again, all of the spiritual forces opposed to God. So this is all of the spiritual forces opposed to God, led by the devil. All of the material, all of the human forces opposed to God, all descend upon God's people in the end and are all destroyed and defeated. This is important because St. John's writing this to people who are under persecution. People to whom Rome seems to have more than the upper hand. Right? They're being slaughtered day and night by Rome. Rome doesn't look like it's even wobbling, let alone falling. Right? But St. John's telling them, this is where this story ends. Right? Not only is this what's really happening now, but here's where this story is going to end, if you stay faithful. Then I saw a great white throne, and him who was seated on it. From his presence, earth and sky fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged by what was written in the books, according to what they had done. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, and each one of them according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. And so this is then the final judgment. This image of the books goes all the way back into the Old Testament and a lot of Second Temple Jewish literature, the idea that there were heavenly tablets, that the things we do and don't do were recorded somewhere and were known somewhere. And there's a record of these things in heaven. This is also where we get the idea of someone's memory when they pass away, when we sing Memory Eternal, right? That their name would be written in the book of life, their name would be recorded forever, right? In God's memory, known to him forever. Okay. And so then the new heavens and the new earth are unveiled, and everything bad is gone. All of the wickedness, all of the sin, all of those who deceive, all of the suffering, all of the pain, all of the mourning. Death is gone. Remember the problems. Death is gone. Sin is gone. The divisions among people are gone. Right? And the new heavens and the new earth exist. There's a new Jerusalem, which if you take very literally in its dimensions is a giant cube. But this isn't the Borg. Right? To give the idea of, as opposed to the sea being chaos, this is absolute order, right? Everything is in its place. Right? It has 12 gates for the 12 tribes of Israel, 12 stones for the 12 apostles, right? And so it, as the church, comes to fill the whole earth. And then the book of Revelation ends with St. John telling us one more time that Christ is coming and that we should all pray that he returns soon. And I'll wrap it up there so we have a little time for questions. So. Yes, ma'am.
When you're talking about intercessors, it seems like maybe the first example of the intercessor would be Moses, as the priest. Is that correct?
Yeah, Moses, Job, when he comes to offer sacrifices for his children and his wife. I don't want to digress on this too much, but priesthood in the Old Testament is tied very much with fatherhood. The idea that a father is to be the priest for the family. And so the people who you see offering sacrifices before the giving of the Torah are always the father. It's Abraham, it's Isaac, it's Jacob, you know, offering sacrifice for the family, leading the worship for the family. The Aaronic priesthood, not ironic, but from Aaron, is really kind of a judgment on Moses. Because, remember, God comes to Moses and says, here, I want you to go and get my people. And he's like, I don't know. And God says, no, you need to go to Egypt and get my people. And he's like, well, I don't talk so good. And God's like, no, look, go. He's like, well, what do I say when they ask what your name is? He says, here's my name. He says, well, but what if they don't believe me? Well, here's some signs you can do. Well, I still don't. Just send somebody else, right? And then finally it says that God is angry with him and he says, okay, your brother Aaron, right? I know he speaks well. We'll do that. And it's not a coincidence that right after that whole episode, even after all that happens, right, God says, okay, I already tapped Aaron on the shoulder in Egypt. He's on his way to meet you. Right? Moses takes off. He doesn't stay to meet Aaron. He goes back to his father-in-law's place. And that's where it turns out he gets condemned by his own wife because he hadn't even circumcised his son. So Moses had fallen down on his responsibilities as a father, right, and as God's prophet. And so as a judgment, he gets the priesthood taken away from him and given to Aaron. Moses was a Levite, but he wasn't allowed to serve as a priest because of that. So yeah, there was an element of judgment there. And that's related to what St. Paul talks about in 1 Timothy and in Titus when he's giving the qualifications for someone to be ordained in the church. And he says they have to have their own household in order first, right? Because if they haven't been faithful with that priesthood, we're not giving them a bigger priesthood, right? Because those two are deeply interrelated.
I read it in the Old Testament. It said he's going to come back at night, and you know, we'd sing the hymn, "Behold the Bridegroom."
Comes at midnight.
Comes at midnight. Could you add anything to that?
Yeah. Well, Christ says, well, you know, what will happen if the Son of Man returns at midnight? And the idea there is that we have to be, you know, no one knows the day or the hour. That we have to be always watchful. That's one of the problems with the way a lot of people interpret the book of Revelation, is that they have this whole wall chart, right, that has to happen first. So they reckon that if they see the first couple events on the wall chart, they're like, okay, well, I got 7.5 years. before this all goes down, so I can kind of wait, right? Which is the exact opposite of what Christ always said. It could be in the middle of the night. It could be at 4 a.m. when no one's awake, you know, because all the night owls go to sleep at 3 and all the early risers get up at 5, right? So what if it's at 4? The idea that we have to could just continuously always be ready. Yeah.
Throughout the lecture, the book of Revelation, you mentioned there at the very end, the thrones for the 12 tribes of Israel.
Yeah.
Could you differentiate or explain, I guess, better, expound upon Israel and the church?
Okay. The short version. Everything we're told in the New Testament is to tell us that the church is the renewed Israel. The church is Israel.
Right.
That it's not that the old Israel was tossed off and then now there's this whole new, it's Israel. Down to the fact that Christ calls 12 disciples, right? We've got the 12 tribes, the 12 patriarchs. Then he has the 70, right? And Moses appointed 70 elders at his father-in-law's suggestion. That story where his father-in-law Jethro shows up and says, you know, man, you're spending all your time doing small claims court with these Israelites, right? Settling all their disputes. Who owns the goat, you know? You got to appoint some people. So he appoints 70 elders, right? And Christ has the 70, right? And then that transfers into how we govern the church. The idea of apostolic succession, the idea of bishops, presbyters, elder, right? It's the same structures. All these things carry over. So the short version is the church is Israel.
So when you hear the word Israel mentioned in the book of Revelation,
yeah,
is that speaking of the nation of Israel as established by Abraham and the promises made to Abraham as far as that group of physical people? It's talking now about Israel being the church.
Well, it's talking about both. Because Galatians, St. Paul tells us we are the children of Abraham. you and I.
Through faith.
Yeah. And that if you don't have faith, then it doesn't matter who you're genetically descended from, you're not a child of Abraham. And Christ says that in St. John's Gospel. Remember, they come to him and they say, we know who our father is, making an accusation at Jesus that he's illegitimate. And then say, our father's Abraham. And he says, no, your father's the devil. Because if your father was Abraham, you'd do what Abraham did. But yeah, you do the works of your father.
You know, in reference back to dispensationalism, was a plan for Israel, was a plan for the church.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and St. Paul even goes so far in Galatians as to say, notice it says seed singular, not plural. Mm-hmm. The promises are to Abraham and his seed singular, meaning Christ, according to St. Paul. Not his everyone descended from him.
I don't know, maybe the last part about the priests and Levi, like Caiaphas was a Sadducee, was he not? Like, so.
Yeah, so he wasn't a Levite at all.
I know that in, I guess all of you, the Sadducees did not believe in resurrection at all. Any
right.
Baptism,
right.
So,
right.
How do you go from like, nation priests, baptized priests, the priesthood of like the tribal,
right,
the ones that were like the high priest of the temple, that kind of priest versus anybody baptized in Christ kind of priest? Like, how's that?
Well, that priesthood, the position of the New Testament and the position of most Jewish literature at the time is that the Sadducees' priesthood was illegitimate. That's where the name Sadducee comes from. It was propaganda. And I'll explain that in a second. But in the Maccabean Revolt, when Judas Maccabeus established an independent Judea in the 2nd century BC, he made his brother the high priest. Right? Which, he's not a Levite, not descended from Aaron, not descended from everybody. And at a couple points in, that's called the Hasmonean dynasty, his descendants. A couple of the Hasmoneans, like John Hyrcanus in 150 AD, was both the high priest and the king at the same time. To give you an example, which was never supposed to happen, right? And he wasn't qualified. So in Ezekiel, when he prophesies the new temple, he talks about the priests there being priests descended from Zadok, who was the faithful priest who helped David when Absalom overthrew him as a reward to Zadok. And so that's where Sadducee comes from. It's Seduki. They called themselves Zadokites. They're trying to claim they were the Zadokite priesthood that Ezekiel prophesied, which of course they weren't. Right? Like, they weren't descended. So yeah, they were considered to be totally illegitimate. A lot of Judaism considered the temple itself, that temple, Herod's temple, to be illegitimate. And wouldn't make use of it for that reason, because of the priesthood and because of the... So the Sadducees, the reason they held on to power is that they owned 70% of the land in Judea and Galilee that wasn't owned by the Romans. And they did that by extracting a temple tax. You see references to the temple tax in the Gospels. And if you couldn't pay the temple tax to the priests, they would take some of your land in turn. And then they would use those people as basically serfs. They'd use them as slave labor on their own land that they had now confiscated. So that's what the high priests and the priests were doing at that time. They were immensely corrupt. And that's why Jesus doesn't have a lot of kind words for them in Holy Week, because they're doing the exact opposite of what they were supposed to be doing. Instead of shepherding the sheep, they were feeding on them.
Where did St. John end his life?
He ended it actually back near Ephesus. He went back to Ephesus and is near Ephesus. We celebrate his repose. Do you know the date?
It's September 8th.
September 8th. And there's a whole story of...
May 8th.
May 8th.
September 8th is the nativity
of the Theotokos. Yeah, May 8th. And his body wasn't found afterwards. Like the Theotokos and Moses's. And Moses's too. Was taken into heaven. That's why Moses has one when he appears on the Mount of Transfiguration, right? Remember, St. Elias, Elijah was taken up into heaven without dying. Moses still has a body because his body was taken up into heaven. And there's a lot of symbolism there in the church's tradition between the Theotokos and Moses, connections there. So.
Do you have time for one more?
Sure.
Okay. I think you can answer quickly, but I think this this touches on how we think about our life as Christians in this world, which is a major theme of your presentation of the Book of the Apocalypse. So, but there's a paradox that struck me as you were speaking. You talked about the authorities in this world, or the powers of this world, the governments of this world, receiving authority from the devil. But we also say...
Insofar as he has it, yeah.
Insofar as he has it. We
right.
also say, St. Paul says, that all authority is from God.
Right.
Which is why we're supposed to show respect, insofar as we're able to the
right.
temporal powers, the temporal authorities. So that's a paradox. How do we
right, yeah. And this, the same St. Paul says that we battle not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities in the heavenly places. Yeah. So I think the key in terms of what he's doing in Romans 13 with our obedience to the government is that St. Paul condemns all forms of rebellion.
Yeah.
Period. Right? All forms of rebellion. When he says that God has given the government the power of the sword to do his will, he isn't saying that everything that a human government does is the will of God. Right? He's saying they've been entrusted with that authority, and that's the standard on which God is going to judge them. Right? But it's not our job to judge them. Right? And so this is the same thing when he talks about, when he tells slaves that they should obey their masters. He's not saying slavery is a great thing. Right? And you should keep it. Right? He's saying, you know, if this is the situation in which you find yourself, you don't be rebellious. Right? And he says, be obedient to them as if you're obeying Christ.
Right?
You be obedient to them as if you're obeying Christ. So it's not an endorsement of those structures of power, right? But it's a rejection of rebellion, which was especially important in the first century, because of course that's how Jerusalem got destroyed. At least a couple of Jesus' disciples were zealots, you know, who were going to take up arms against Rome. And Christians didn't take up arms against Rome. And it's related to that theme of martyrdom. Right? Christianity generated all these martyrs because when the authorities came to kill someone for being a Christian, the Christians went to their death. They didn't start a rebellion. There was no Masada for Christians. And so that's a very different approach to how we see authority. So it's, we obey them as if they were doing what they're supposed to be doing, right? Even though in a lot of cases they're not.
Right.
You know? And then the people who are in positions of power and authority, whether they're Christians or not, are going to be held to that standard of how they utilize that power and authority that they received in this life, or wealth, or whatever other abilities, you know, and gifts God has given us, how we use them. But in terms of how we look to people who are in authority over us, whether they're wicked or whether they're righteous, right, we obey them as if they were.
Yeah, and I think of David treating Saul as God's anointed, even when Saul was trying to kill him.
Right, even after he had been anointed. Even after David had been anointed. Yeah.
Because he was the one who God had anointed, he would not lay his hands on him.
Yeah.
But it seems like we have to be very clear about that distinction that you're making, that we have these temporal authorities over us, and we're not to be in rebellion against them, but we're to obey them as if we're obeying God.
Right.
Who allows them to be an authority.
Right.
And yet we don't blindly follow them, but we have to be very...
Or endorse what they're doing, or worship them, or follow them. Yeah. Yeah.
That seems like that takes a lot of discernment.
Yeah.
That would be very confusing in this day and age.
Yeah. Yeah, and you get the whole wrinkle of this being a democracy thrown in, right? Or some kind of republic, whatever you want to say, democratic republic. But once democracy is thrown in, well, now it is sort of my job to hold the authorities accountable, sort of, right? At least in some way. Which of course wasn't a burden they had in the first century because Caesar didn't care, right? What any of them had to say. But that also makes us, in a certain sense, participants in the government in a different way and brings more accountability to us in terms of how we interact and what we say and what we don't say and what we let happen and don't let happen. Because God's given us in this day and age at least some little ability to influence that in some way. And so we have to take into account how we're going to use that influence, even if it's just a little bit.
Well, it seems like the only way we can do that is by hanging on close to the church, otherwise we can't do it at all.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it has to start with, there was a great clarity here for the Christians, or could have been, there was, that they were going to have to be their own community and cut themselves off from everything in the world because the world was so openly hostile. Because the world is now maybe less open about it, there's a tendency for us to think, well, maybe it's not so hostile. Right? And maybe we can stand with one foot here and one foot there a little better because, you know, after all, they're not offering pagan sacrifices literally anymore. Right? And they're not, you know, doing all these things literally. And so that can make it harder for us because it's a little more ambiguous. The hostility is a little more hidden. Of course, now in our present day, that hostility is becoming more open. And so, you know, we're going to have additional clarity, I think, going forward. But yeah, it's not as clear a line for us as it maybe was at different periods in the past. So.
Thank you, Father.
Oh.